All right, today we are talking on the 30 Years' War and the Church in the Desert, and the Church in the Desert will be our discussion upon the French Huguenots. So we're going to talk about 30 Years' War, something that impacted all of Europe, but impacted the German area, the Holy Roman Empire, most, and the Church in the Desert, something that mainly impacted Christians who were in the area of France. So let's begin. 30 Years' War. 30 Years' War began in 1618 and ended in 1648. It is the last major war of the Protestant Reformation. Gonzalez states that the 30 Years' War was likely the bloodiest and most devastating European war prior to the 20th century. This was a very big war. It was begun in and was mostly fought within the area, what is known as the Holy Roman Empire, which at this time period was basically the area of Germany. Just as a review, we need to remember the Treaty of Augsburg was signed. This allowed Lutherans to exist within the Holy Roman Empire. It did not allow Lutherans to exist in all of Europe everywhere freely. It allowed them to freely exist within the Holy Roman Empire. However, and this is very important, we need to remember this throughout the whole conversation of this study, it did not allow other Christian sects to exist, such as Anabaptists. Anabaptists were not allowed to exist. However, this is a point that I want to drive home. This is my opinion, though. Although it didn't allow everyone individually to exist, I mean, it didn't allow everyone to, to be Baptist or to be some offshoot. In bringing this about, it gave credence to the idea that there were other options behind Roman Catholicism. And so if there's Lutheranism as an option, it kind of opened the door to, well, why couldn't Calvinism also be an option? And as this 30 Years' War begins to open up and break out, you have many Calvinists that are very influential and who have great amounts of power and are very helpful to the Protestants in the fighting this 30 Years' War, and they end up being named as a legitimate religion at the end of this because the Pope really has no other choice. And when we get to the end of this, the Pope's place is going to be much different at this time, and the Holy Roman Empire's existence is going to be much different, and the Holy Roman Emperor is, for the most part, just going to be a figurehead when all of this is done, and this is going to open up the doors to what is known as what we now recognize as the idea of a secular state, and a church that, a state that has a separation of church and state, not wanting to go down that too far, because what it looks like here and what it looks like in more modern times is going to be is very distinct, but it certainly is the beginnings of this. The Treaty of Augsburg didn't allow everyone individually to be Lutheran or Catholic, and this led to a lot of problems. It also led to a lot of inconsistencies. It allowed the leader of a region, so a particular prince or a particular king who was in a region, if they were Lutheran, then that region would be Lutheran. If the prince was Catholic, then that region would have to be Catholic. This caused a lot of problems. One of the main problems is that you have a new prince that comes in, and everyone was Protestant, and now suddenly they're expected to become Roman Catholic. Now, some princes were crazy enough to try to enforce that, and others were sensible enough to recognize that that was foolish, and they needed to, rule peacefully. It's important to recognize two things about this treaty. Number one is that the Roman Catholic Pope didn't really like this treaty. The Roman Catholic Pope had to sign this treaty because it was necessary at the time, because the Lutherans were putting up such a fight during the mid-1500s. And secondly, we need to remember throughout this time that it does not include Calvinists. So when I say Protestants, you're going to constantly think that I'm talking about, all of Protestants as we would think today. We're not. All we're talking about is only Lutherans when we use the term Protestants up until the end of the 30 Years' War. Continuing on, I did some study on this, on the 30 Years' War. I wasn't very familiar with it. I knew it was a big deal. I knew a lot of people died in it, and I knew it had some religious significance, but I went on the internet, and I wanted to watch a couple videos to kind of familiarize myself with it so that when I came in here, I didn't just dump truck a bunch of information on you. I wanted to be able to generalize it. And I went on the internet, and I saw a video on the 30 Years' War from the History Channel, and I thought, well, this should be useful information. I mean, right, it's the History Channel. That's what they do. They're all about history. So I clicked on that video first, and this is how it began. It began in saying that the first thing you need to understand about the 30 Years' War is the distinction between the teachings of Martin Luther and John Calvin. I said, oh, okay, this should be good. All right, I like this. I can bring some theological points into what we're going to talk about today. And he begins to say, and the key difference between Lutheran theology and John Calvin's theology, though there are many differences, but the key distinction between the teachings of John Calvin and Martin Luther are that John Calvin believed in a teaching of predestination, which meant that God had called certain people to be his own from the beginning of the world. And I just like did a facepalm, and I didn't get past that part of the video because it's like, have they never heard of, you know, bondage of the will? The debate that Martin Luther had with Erasmus. And so anyway, I didn't finish that one. Y'all didn't find that near as amusing as I did. I was having trouble holding back a laugh for, I mean, almost the next day. Janice laughed about as much at that as all of you did. But that is an incredible historical inaccuracy. I mean, whoever did that, I would assume, has a PhD or some level of understanding of history, but they had no understanding of the theological beliefs as far as the soteriology was concerned of Martin Luther or John Calvin to make such a blatant error. So anyways, okay, next to the 30 Years' War, there's four main phases of the 30 Years' War. The first two are going to be regional. They're just in specific regions. And then when we get to these last two, that's when it's much more intense and it's more of a continental war. So we're going to have the Bohemian phase and the Danish phase. That's the localized battles. And then the Swedish phase and the French phase. And as the war progresses, the Protestants are more successful. At the beginning, they're not as successful. Bohemia is in the area of the modern Czech Republic, as you can see up there. The main areas that we're going to be discussing here, key points you need to recognize are Bohemia and Bavaria. Bavaria is ruled by Roman Catholics, and it's heavily Roman Catholic. Bohemia, at this time, I believe, is ruled by a Roman Catholic. However, the vast majority of it is Protestant, and so they're allowing the Protestants in that area to be Protestants. And that's kind of the problem that we mentioned earlier, is that whenever you have a leader that maybe was Protestant and then become Roman Catholic, and you have a great majority of Protestants in an area, and then the next leader becomes Roman Catholic, well, everyone doesn't just necessarily change their religion because they get a new king. And that would make complete sense if you actually believed in the religion that you hold to. If you really believe in the teachings of salvation by grace alone through faith, well, just because you get a new president, you're not, and he doesn't hold to that view, you're not necessarily going to change it. And if you're very consistent and mature in your faith and you begin to get some kind of persecution that's pushing on you, you're not even going to change. And so it's going to cause a lot of disruption in the area. So that's what we have here in this area of Bohemia. It had the Protestant majority, but they had a Roman Catholic leader. So events leading up to this war, violence had begun to break out between Protestants and Roman Catholics. And that was within this area of Bavaria in an area named Donauwörth. And it led to just a lot of tension there and a lot of battles that were constantly occurring. And it got to the point that almost within this one city, most of the city was Protestant. And the only area in which there was still, you know, Roman Catholic existence there was this one Catholic monastery. And the monks were allowed to practice what they did within their monastery, but they were not to bring it out of the monastery. Well, the monks chose to do a procession and began to march through the city as monks, doing what monks do, probably praying or doing something of the sort, probably nothing violent. And a mob ran up and beat the monks. So they threw rocks at them, beat on them with sticks, and injured them, and they were all forced to flee back into the monastery. Well, this caused a great problem because now this is not going to work out. There's a Roman Catholic leader here. The Roman Catholic leader here holds the sword, and he was allowing Protestants and Catholics to exist, but now there's this violence that's continually breaking up, hitting a climax where these monks are attacked. And the Duke Maximilian of Bavaria chose to invade the city of Dovenwerth, and his goal was to destroy all of Protestantism and force mass conversions within in the city. Now, this caused great problems. The evangelicals and the Catholics began to make their own separate unions. You had an evangelical union and what's known as the Catholic League. Evangelicals at this time did not have anywhere near the forces or arms that the Catholics had at this time, so they really couldn't defeat the Catholics, but they at least had some kind of a unity at this time. And this is important because it's from this that they're going to continue to grow into the force that you're going to see within that which exists within the 30 Years' War. Because you need to remember, there's a lot of Protestantism along the edges, up in the Scandinavian areas and into Denmark and some of these eastern areas, into Poland and some of the outskirts of Hungary, and there within France and Switzerland, and then scattered throughout the Holy Roman Empire, you also have Protestant influence there. But they're not all necessarily united together the way they would need to be. Now, the other problem within Bohemia is that there were, like I said, there were more Protestants than Catholics within this area. But there was also a large amount of Calvinist influence that was here. And this was another goal that the Roman Catholic Church had, was to deal with this great, what was legally called a heretical movement. So anything that wasn't Roman Catholic or Lutheran was called heresy. So what do you do with heretics during this time? Well, you force them to recant, or you burn them at the stake. Or you know, in some way you persecute them until they either flee or they recant or they die. And this is something that the Holy Roman Emperor Rudolf II took upon himself. He was a staunch Roman Catholic, and his goal was to force all of these Calvinists to recant and to change, and this did not go over well for him. Some of the Lutherans were even standing on his side. He had to step down. His brother, the successor, came forward. He didn't last as long. And what this led to was a lot of the Habsburg leaders within this eastern area. Remember, you have Habsburgs that existed within Spain, and you also have Habsburgs that exist on this eastern portion. They're known as Austrian Habsburgs. And they allowed people more of a freedom to worship as they chose because they wanted to stay in power, and they didn't want to have this great bloodshed that they saw would ultimately come about. So this had kind of been in existence for a little while. There was this allowance, and I say this generally, as you go through different areas, it can be distinct. So I'm skipping over a lot of the details here, but you could have a prince in this area that was more intense than others, and others that were just kind of wanting to have a Pax Romana. But what you have is generally they were allowing this freedom of worship under the Habsburgs. Emperor Ferdinand II, things began to change. Emperor Ferdinand revoked the freedom of religion that existed in Bohemia that allowed Protestants to worship and rule as they desired. This, of course, wasn't very popular. So to deal with this, so Ferdinand's first way he dealt with this, which is a very common way in which Roman Catholics deal with such things at this time period, is they just send some people to those that they desire to recant, and they just tell them, okay, things are changing now, so you're not going to be Protestants anymore. You are now going to be Catholics. This is what we expect of you. And then the Protestants would respond, yes, but, you know, we are Protestants, and we've been raised Protestants, and look at the Bible. They're not going to discuss any of that. They're just going to continue to repeat the same thing. Well, this didn't go over very well with the Protestants in Prague, and so you had what is known as the defenestration of Prague. And the Protestants took these Roman Catholic ambassadors, or this Roman Catholic, took the people that Ferdinand II had sent, and they threw them out of a window. It's a very famous occurrence. So they were thrown out the window, probably what would amount to about 70 feet that they fell out of this castle-type building window, and they survived. They didn't die from the fall. So there's two different perspectives on what happened with them here. The Roman Catholics have the perspective that, and this is the story as it goes, that Mary appeared along with a legion of angels, maybe not a legion, but a few angels, and they caught these men and protected their fall, and they were able to go back safe to Ferdinand II, and he was furious when he found out about this, and he's going to respond very quickly and harshly to this action. But the Protestant view is that there was just basically a big pile of human waste on the side of this building in this area. The way this would work in a castle is that there are some places that, I'm not an expert on castles, but I do, some places had types of plumbing, but many places didn't. And so you would just basically dump whatever trash or, you know, human waste that you had onto the side of a castle, and it would just pile and pile amongst all the trash, and that's what you had on that side of the castle. Don't play on that side of the castle, kids. And according to the Protestants, that's what they fell into, and that broke their fall. Even if that's what happened, it's still pretty incredible that these guys fell what amounts to 70 feet, and they were able to get on their horses and ride home. The Bohemians called on a man named Frederick, the Elector of Palatinate, and here is where that area is. See where Wittenberg is, just north of there, that little gray area that looks like a three-sided Chinese star is that area. So you can see it's across the area from Bavaria, and they reached way over there to get their leader, and this did not go over well. The Holy Roman Emperor was not happy with this, that they would reach over there to get their next leader. And so he was angered, and he sent troops into battle. And we had what is known as the Battle of White Mountain, which was a major Roman Catholic victory. And after this, Frederick was removed. The next phase we have is what's known as the Danish phase. Danish king, his name is Christian IV, became concerned over this Roman Catholic attack at the Battle of White Mountain. And he was concerned that, okay, if they just begin to do this with Protestants here, it's not going to be very long until they march up to Denmark and they begin to do the same thing with us over in this area. So he gathers together an army and he chooses to invade the Roman Catholic Empire and the Holy Roman Empire, and not successful, not even close. They basically ran him back into Denmark and even continued to attack him for a while there and then backed off. The great general there that was involved in this was named Wallenstein. He was a general for Ferdinand II that worked for him on and off throughout the 30 Years' War. By the way, if the 30 Years' War is something you're really fascinated in, I mean, there were books with thousands and thousands of pages written on this topic. There's a lot of little skirmishes and battles and a lot of other details that we're not even going to touch right now. Next phase, we begin the Continental phase, and this is what we would call the Swedish phase of the 30 Years' War. Gustavus Adolphus, and if you are someone who is a war buff, you have heard of the name of Gustavus Adolphus. He was a Lutheran king of Sweden. They were and he chose to invade the Roman Catholic Empire, but he had the support of France. And this is really important to recognize what's going on here with France, because France is a Roman Catholic country. But you need to understand that the French are very concerned over the Habsburgs that are all around them. So you have Habsburgs over in Spain, and Habsburgs over in Austria, and their influence throughout the Holy Roman Empire. And then you have them up in the Netherlands and in northern Italy. And so it's kind of like a power struggle for them. They want to kind of tip the balances of power a little bit. So they are going to fund the Swedish king as he invades the Holy Roman Empire. Additionally, Protestants in Germany worked with him in this area. And as he went through and he attacked, he was very successful because there's one main thing that made him so successful, and that was that he had movable artillery. Prior to this, when you set up your cannons, it took a long time to set them up, and you set them up, and that's the way they faced, and that's the way they were going to face the rest of the war, and that's it. So obviously, if you're on the other side, you're going to wait till they shoot, and that's the other thing. They would generally volley them all at once, and then reload them, and volley them all at once, and reload them. And you just recognize, okay, a bunch of us are going to die as we're doing this, and the next person's just going to step up in line. And kind of like, as you've seen, the wars in the colonies between the British, where they would just line up in a war, and they just shoot each other, and the next lines would just shoot each other, but then the Americans changed that. Because they recognize, well, we're not going to be able to survive such a volley, and that's going to be crazy. So we're just going to stand in the woods and, you know, kind of pick people off, and we're going to be very mobile. That's kind of what Gustavus did here, in that he had this, and you can go and study this on your own if you find it interesting, but he had the ability to move his artillery around, and he had a, not quite guerrilla warfare, but he had the ability to move around very efficiently, and the other side was not ready for that. He was an honorable person, I think, in that as he went through Germany, he had told the French that no town or hamlet or village or city that we conquer is going to become French. For Gustavus, this was not about taking on more territory. This was about dealing with the encroachment of the Roman Catholics into the Protestant areas. And he also didn't force Roman Catholics to convert. So he would, basically it was, y'all are going to stop attacking the Protestants, but the goal wasn't to form a mass conversion of Roman Catholics, which, by the way, would be something that's consistent with Protestant theology. You don't become a Christian because someone puts a gun to your head. And he's known as the father of modern warfare. I don't know if I mentioned that part. His most successful battle was in the Battle of Breitenfeld, and that ended this particular part. But Gustavus Adolphus, during this time, just as most kings during this time did when they fought, he led the charge. He was there in the midst of all the fighting, and so he was struck down. When he was struck down, the Swedes began to pull out of the war, which leads us to the next phase, which is the French phase, which is the great irony, because the French are a Roman Catholic country, and there's many details we could discuss here, but we're not going to. The Swedes began to support the French financially. Now, they basically traded sides, so now the French are doing most of the fighting, but the Swedes are assisting the French. And many Protestants are assisting the French as well and are allies with them. And the French end up becoming more successful. It's not as though you get to the end of this war and then it's like, hey, we got a decisive winner, we won. It's like, it gets to the end, it's like 30 years, and maybe we'd like to do something besides just fight each other all the time. That's kind of where the war ends. And you have what's known as the peace of Westphalia, and what happens is that Ferdinand II dies, and Ferdinand III is the successor, and he's a Roman Catholic. However, he's not as intolerant as his father was, and there had just been incredible fighting throughout Germany. Most of this had been throughout Germany, throughout the Holy Roman Empire, And this idea that we have in modern times that I'm going to have an army that's going to invade, like let's say in Iraq, we invaded Iraq, but we had, you know, it was controversial at the time, but Halliburton was supplying the troops with all of their food and all of the necessary supplies that they needed. Well, this idea of supplying your troops with all of their supplies that they need is kind of a modern idea. Armies during this time period didn't have, you know, like people bringing them food from thousands of miles away. An army would get their supplies from wherever they were. So if they were in an allied territory, that's where they got their food and supplies. And maybe at first it wasn't as big of a deal. But when you have an enemy army roll through there, they're going to pillage the place. They're going to raise the village. They're going to pillage the village, and they're going to take their supplies from there. And so you just have villages that are just being destroyed and cities that are just being destroyed. And what happens is that no one's really ever happy to see the army. It could be your allies, and it could be your foes, and you're not really happy to see any of them because you know what they're going to do to your houses and to your economy and to your family, and it's a disaster. This was one of the big problems that happened with the Crusades throughout all of those years, was there was just incredible immorality that went on with the soldiers that fought within them. And what happens to people during this time is that they just stop investing. I mean, why am I going to take the time to plant all of these crops and to grow all of this food when I'm not really going to make a profit all of this? Someone at some point randomly is going to come in and just, you know, take all that I've worked for and take all that I have. And they just, why keep doing it? What's the point in building something up if someone's just going to come and tear it down and destroy it? And so you have an entire generation of people here that just begin to say, why are we doing this anyway? What's the point of this? And everyone just pretty much stops fighting. France, Sweden, and Germany are all ready to stop. I would imagine, this is my opinion, the only person that wasn't ready to stop was probably the Pope. He's the one that lost the most in this whole process. From this point on, the Pope's rule is going to be much different. He's not going to have the power that he had before. For instance, in France, there was a man we'll talk about here in a minute named Cardinal Richelieu, and he was the one that was basically ruling for the king and directing the armed forces and how they would go. You're going to begin to see that begin to wane away. You're not going to see people having these dual titles where I'm controlling the army and I'm a cardinal within the church. This treaty was signed in 1648, and some major things that happened. It removed the major power from the Holy Roman Emperor. He no longer controlled the princes in the empire, and it's probably the most important aspect for the treaty for us. It removed all the authority the Holy Roman Emperor had over the princes. So at this point, he's nothing more than a figurehead. If you can't tax people, if you can't make laws, if you don't have an army, well, you don't really have any governing authority anymore. And that's all that he really was at this point. He was just a figurehead. Maybe a little more than a figurehead, but for the most part, he was just a figurehead. Which leads Voltaire during this time to give the quote here that the Holy Roman Empire is neither holy nor Roman nor an empire. Additionally, as a result of the end of this war, Calvinism becomes an accepted religion, and they have the same rights as the Lutherans and the Catholics do within the Roman Empire. However, we need to remember that the same thing was not given to the Anabaptists. And although we as Reformed Baptists, our lineage doesn't necessarily, you know, flow right out from the Anabaptists, but we would have been thrown into this group in the same way, so we would have been considered heretics by all the other major religions at this time. This treaty also allows for the subjects and the rulers to choose their own religion. So it doesn't matter who your leader is. As one of the subjects in this area, you can practice any of the three religions that you chose, either Calvinism, Lutheranism, or Roman Catholicism. Within this, land also gets divided. This is very important. The boundaries of France get extended. Switzerland becomes this is kind of the birth of what we consider to be, this is kind of more the birth of Switzerland here. Sweden gains land. Brandenburg, which is in that northern portion up there, land is gained up there by Calvinists. So you kind of see how the empire is encroaching in that, is kind of pushed in that area as Calvinists have taken over that area. And here's something else that Gonzalez points out that's a consequence of it, is that it's the growing belief was that religion should be something that is private for you and yourself. Now, not the modern idea that you don't ever talk about it, but rather the idea that you don't, you know, your king doesn't go and fight a war with someone else because they have a different religion than you do. It's not like it was, not like the belief is today, but this was probably the beginnings of that. Gonzalez has this quote. He says, "The principles of tolerance of the Peace of Westphalia were not born out of a deeper understanding of Christian love, but rather out of the growing indifference to religion, accompanied by the feeling, even among those with deep religious commitments, that such commitments should remain private and not be carried into civil and political life." This does not mean that it shouldn't impact the laws that are there. Don't take it to that extreme. That was not the view there. The view, you need to understand this to be that we're not going to take the sword. We're not going to, you know, attack each other over this reason. I don't think this is only about religion, this 30 Years' War. There were very serious religious overtones of the war, but that wasn't the main point. Some other results of this war... although everyone's main motivation may not have been religious, I think there was a lot of power struggle that was going on here. They had some very significant religious impacts here. And it was a change with how the Pope would deal with leaders. And it was also the most important aspect of this for us is to recognize that it allowed Protestants to freely live and exist and proclaim the gospel. They could go and proclaim the gospel freely without, you know, being threatened, without being attacked. These attacks were very successful throughout Roman Catholic history, and that's why they would go back to him so many times, because it was very, very successful to go and to do that. You have John Huss as one example. He preached the gospel, but his mouth was shut because he was burned at the stake. You have the Waldensians that we mentioned, their influence, though they would go around and preach the gospel. As they began to be attacked, thousands and thousands of them were killed. And the Roman Catholics were successful in stifling the proclamation of the gospel and the distribution of the word of God. But this was a different era. Things have changed during this time. And the first one that I want to point to is what we pointed to in the beginning, was the invention of the printing press. It allowed the dissemination of information very, very quickly. So you could kill the person that wrote it, and it could actually work against you, because the person publishes this work that's being published, and then the Roman Catholic authorities kill that person. Well, now everyone wants to read his book, so it makes it even worse. And so the person's message lives long, long after their death. So I just want to impact the importance of the printing press and also how it impacted what we have here. The growth of these states that exist are able to exist because people are having a common language, and they're beginning to have a common national identity. And they're able to do that because they're becoming literate, and they're able to relate to one another based upon a language. And the leaders are able to publish laws that people are able to understand. They're able to disseminate the information very quickly. And it is why you're having... in some ways, you're having a lot of wars on account of this that just did not occur at other times, when things just moved a whole lot slower. Last thing it gave was it gave the princes greater power, and it lessened the power of the Pope. Next area that we're going to talk through is, kind of quickly in the next 15 minutes, is going to be this: the church in the desert. During this time, we're going to talk about the French Huguenots, and some of this content that we're going to talk about here is going to precede the 30 Years' War, is going to kind of walk through it, and then is going to deal with times that are after the 30 Years' War. So this isn't strictly chronological, but who are the French Huguenots? All this begins with what is known as, where I'm going to begin this, is what is known as the Edict of Nantes. The Edict of Nantes was granted by a king in France. His name is King Henry IV, and he allowed the Huguenots, which were French Calvinists, the rights to exist. So you can see the contradictions that are going on here. It's illegal to be a Calvinist over here in Germany, but France over here, who is a Roman Catholic country, is granting Calvinists the right to exist freely. So you can see how there's these tensions and contradictions that are occurring here that other people on this side are saying, hey, wait, why shouldn't we have the same powers and authorities that they have? This was the beginning, probably, of what we have in the secular state of France, which was the king here was not forcing everyone to stay under the same particular religion. He was allowing there to be, many different, not many different, but different religions that existed under his rule, and possibly what led to a lot of what you see within the French Revolution, which the French Revolution is strongly secular, very anti-religious in how it worked, and led to great chaos, led to great disorder, led to a heavy-handed emperor that had to come in and take control of everything because there was such chaos at this time, and the man's name was Napoleon. We need to understand that the effects of the 30 Years' War, they're not just primarily religious. When you look through the Bible, you're not going to find anything in the Bible that tells you that you are to take your sword and to force other people to repent and to trust in Christ alone. You're not going to find anything in the Bible that tells you to take out a sword and to force other people to submit themselves under the authority of the Pope and the Roman Catholic Church. This is not primarily just religious, although it had great religious impacts here. And you can hear different people talk about this, and they're going to take a different view that I'm going to take. And you definitely don't have anything that says that there's going to be a Holy Roman Emperor and a pope who are going to rule over the church and the state within the world. This Edict of Nantes allowed the French Huguenots to exist, and it was also something that was necessary for the French king because, as I said, he had Habsburgs on all sides of him, and he did not have he probably didn't think he had the resources to be fighting a civil war on the inside of his country and then fighting wars on the outside of his country as well. And so this was probably a matter of survival is why he made this particular decision. So therefore, after the Edict of Nantes, this is the important part, I said all that to say this, the Huguenots were loyal subjects of the crown. There's only one thing that they did get, though, and this became a problem later on, is that they were given multiple fortified cities. So they had kind of a Texan independent type spirit that, okay, we're subject unto you, but if there's ever a problem, we have fortified cities and we have the ability to defend ourselves. Louis VIII became king when he was 8 years old, and his mother's name was Marie de Massini, and she's the one that did most of the governing during this time. And what she did was, instead of her doing most of the governing, was she gave that authority over to Italian officials who would give guidance during this time for them. And they didn't really understand the power structure in France or why things were set up the way they were. But what they did see is that you had these heretics that were allowed to freely exist in fortified cities within France. And they saw that as a great problem. Going on here, Louis VIII went on to marry Anne of Austria, and his sister Isabella was married to who would be the future king of Spain, Philip IV. And this marriage between them caused great problems because they began to see this as more of a going along with the way that the Spanish had handled what they considered to be heresy, which was to completely wipe it out. And it led to a great provocation from the Huguenots. And they desired to have a change of French policy. They took arms up at this point. Cardinal Richelieu was a man who began to rise in power. He was very influential in France throughout the 30 Years' War. He's one who didn't lead the troops in battle, but was one who was very influential in how France was run during this time. And he's also one that supported Protestants financially and later militarily in the Thirty Years' War, but not the Huguenots. That's what you need to understand here. In the Thirty Years' War, he supported the Protestants for the purpose of standing up against the Habsburgs and having greater control in his area of Europe. But he was very much a man who desired to control that which he reigned over, and he desired centralized power, and he was not okay with these Huguenots having these fortified cities, and they desired for them to give them up. The Huguenots refused, and you have what is known as the Siege of La Rochelle. And if you speak French, I'm probably slaughtering these words because I'm seeing some of your faces as I say them, and I'm sorry I don't speak French. So this is the Texan version of how you would say these words. But the Siege of Rochelle lasted over a year. So they bombarded these Huguenots for over a year. And after a year, only 1,500 out of 25,000 of these Huguenots survived. That's an incredible loss. They just basically, like the Alamo, they just sat outside for a while and let everyone starve and let everyone run out of supplies. And they just gradually just began to beat upon the city walls until they could no longer stand up and defend themselves. The French went in. They destroyed the fortifications of the Huguenot cities. They went in and performed a mass in every Huguenot church that existed within the cities. But the cardinal allowed the Huguenots to continue to exist because for him it really wasn't about whether or not you're practicing a different religion. It was more a matter of sovereignty here. And he didn't like having someone in the middle of his empire that as he's out at war somewhere could rise up and cause a problem for him. So the Huguenots got to continue to exist, just not as a competing political power. Richelieu and King Henry IV died about within a year of each other, which led to the great French king, King Louis XIV. He took the throne when he was 5 years old. His mother was Anne of Austria, who we mentioned earlier. And this man, Cardinal Mazarin, took over control of the affairs of state. How incredibly contrary this is to anything that we're used to. This is a cardinal who is running the, basically almost like a chief of staff here. He's running the country here because the king is at this point 5 years old. Cardinal Mazarin dies. By the way, Cardinal Mazarin is important because he continued to allow the Huguenots to exist as they had under the previous cardinal. However, he dies. Louis XIV desired to show some sovereignty over the Roman Catholic Pope and did not put another cardinal in the same position. However, he was a strong Catholic. He believed in more of a kind of a French Catholic Church, a certain amount of sovereignty that existed there. And he began to put pressure on the Huguenots to convert. He wanted to bring in all the Protestants in France, basically reunite them with the church. He wanted them all to come back together. He began to just put light pressure or make things uncomfortable for them. Then he went on, when that didn't work, and he began to try to bribe them. He would basically try to buy them back into the church, and this was very successful. Close to 10,000 of them came back and recanted and joined the French Roman Catholic Church, which he calls the Galatian Church. I think we're going to deal with that later on, so I'm not going to go into details about it. But many of them repented, and that's the wrong word, but recanted. And then he gave out the Edict of Fontainebleau. And the Edict of Fontainebleau abolished the Edict of Nantes. Protestantism now was officially criminal in France. So, and it was very serious. Serious persecution came upon them. And Huguenots fled to Switzerland, Germany, England, the Netherlands. Some of them even fled to North America. This caused a serious economic disruption within the country of France because many of these Huguenots were upper middle class, artisan people, merchants, craftsmen, and they were very important to the economy of France. So Louis XIV wasn't seeing all that, all that would happen here. Gonzalez goes so far as to say that this likely led to the many economic problems that led to the French Revolution. That's his opinion there. But the Protestants in France had to remain hidden. Many, because I don't know for sure. But many of them had recanted under the pressure of the torture or, you know, whatever had happened to them. But then they continued to worship as Protestants. So they would gather in the woods, they would sing, they would listen to the word preached, they would break bread together. The French would, you know, look through the woods and try to find such people, try to find these secret meetings, wait till everyone was in there, and then they would go in, they would take the men, send them to the gallows, they would take the women, they would put them in lifetime imprisonment, they would take the children away from them, put them into French foster homes, and they would be raised as Roman Catholics. This caused serious disruption for the church, because a lot of major people had left, and so theology got a little wacky during this time. Pierre Jury, I'm not saying his name right, sorry, published a commentary on the book of Revelation that said that the final victory was going to take place in the year of 1689. The Lord was going to come and make things straight. Many believe this is a false prophecy. But, you know, there was a great event that happened in the year of 1689, so maybe there might be something to some of what he said. Just joking at that. Still a cessationist. Protestantism began to spread throughout France, so as they persecuted them, they actually began to spread, and they ended up with an army, and their army was called... I forgot what they're called, but they had an army with a very unique name of peasants. But the way they would work is they had this army of 25,000, but they would just kind of attack 100 people at a time, 100 people here, and they caused great havoc in the French Empire during this time period. But the French took a different strategy at this. They didn't know who necessarily did this, but they knew where they came from. So they just ran in and just burned down villages and hamlets and cities and just destroyed everything that the people had, and that really knocked the wind out of this rebellion movement. There were leaders in France that did not advocate raising up arms against the state. One man was named Antoine Court. He was a Reformed pastor who had learned under the teachings of Calvin and Beza, and he taught that they should obey the leaders unless they're forced to do something that violates Scripture. He's also the founder of what's known as the French Reformed Church. And so they ended up having, in time, they ended up having freedom under the French rule, and they were allowed later on to, I think it's under Louis XVI. Louis XVI had granted them the freedom to worship as they chose. That is right on the heels of the French Revolution. That's where things really get, you got Robespierre and the French, we're not going into that, but that's where things get really crazy in France. But what I want to emphasize here is so much of these wars that had occurred in the 30 Years' War and within all these battles that occurred within France just gave a lot of people a lot of distrust in religion. You have this rationalist movement that's coming up now, and I think Aaron may be dealing with that in a couple of weeks. One of us will. And it just kind of disregards, just kind of sees a lot of this religion as foolishness, sees this doesn't do anything but cause great wars, and Voltaire is one of those examples that makes this particular argument. I do want to emphasize, though, that that's not a consistent point of view, because, yes, it is true that there was a religion that was involved in these wars that occurred, but there was secularism that was involved in the French Revolution, and that led to great war and social chaos and problems as well. And we need to remember that this is not something that our religion doesn't call us to take up arms for the purpose of converting someone. I know none of us in here have that particular perspective, but we have to see this through through the right eyes, the right point of view. That's a common point that's brought up by like a Dawkins, is he'll say, well, you know, religion just leads to these great wars. Well, maybe, but also a really misunderstood point of view of religion. So much that was being fought over during this time has nothing to do with religion. No Holy Roman Empire. There's no such thing as the Pope in the Bible. Not all of these, so much of this that was the cause of these fights, not a part of the religion itself. I'm going to close with this quote here, which is kind of what I was just saying. From Gonzales, he says, during those years of persecution and resistance, of horror and glory, the minds were shaped that would later espouse the ideals of the French Revolution. And, you know, ideas have consequences, and so do actions. And there are, you know, Christians that make very poor choices at times, and some people that aren't even Christians. And they do poor choices. Was the wrong statement. I should have said sinful choices. But same point said, there are people that declare that they're Christians and then do sinful actions, but they're not even Christians in and of themselves. And all of Christianity can't be blamed for the Crusades and the 30 Years' War and all of these particular actions, because those are not Christian activities in and of themselves. Ravi Zacharias has this point that he made with someone that had charged him with, you know, all these atrocities that happened throughout history in the name of Christ. And he said, you know, suppose that I went and I took your jacket and your hat and I went off and I murdered someone. And I took your jacket and your hat and I put it back in its place. And then someone saw you with your jacket and your hat on and they accused you of the murder that I had just done. You would be appalled by it. And they say, yeah, but you look just like the person. Say, yes, but you know that I'm not the person that did this. The person was just wearing my jacket and my hat. And that's kind of what happens, is that people take on the name of Christ and they go and they do some great atrocity, and they weren't even Christians necessarily in and of themselves, but yet that same that's blamed upon all of Christians, as though you're to take all of it on. And this is just something that as a Christian you have to answer within modern times. Sometimes these are things you have to answer. Sometimes people are also reasonable, and they understand that there's a distinction here and there's a separateness. And the other thing is that we're Reformed Baptist, and up until this point, no one liked us. Everyone was killing Baptists at this time. So that may be an overstatement, but many people were killing Baptists. It was still considered a heretical religion. Any comments or questions?